The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Light of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish thought and practice based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKolel, Dean of the Kolel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled How to Become Wealthy, is dedicated to the memory and the Ilui Nishmos Tzvi Hirsch Bereb Avraham Yitzchok, Rivka Bas Reb Binyamin, Binyamin Bereb Aaron, Tzipora Bas Reb Chaim, Avraham Yitzchok Bereb Avraham, Ubela Bas Reb Avraham Aleha Mashalom, of blessed memory.
One of the world's most beloved and successful record-breaking productions of all time was the hit musical, Fiddler on the Roof. Although this story was set in the Jewish shtetl of Eastern Europe, its universal theme won the hearts and applause of audiences as far away as Japan. One of the most endearing songs of that production was If I Were a Rich Man. It brilliantly captures the longings of all those who unsuccessfully pursue wealth. Permit me to read the lyrics of that song with commentary. The lyrics are on page 9 of your handout. Tevye, the poor milkman and hero of the play, begins with a prayer of sorts. Ah, dear Lord, you made many, many poor people. I realize, of course, that it's no shame to be poor, but it's no great honor either. So what would have been so terrible if I had a small fortune? He then begins to sing, and with the beginning of the refrain, if I were a rich man, yabby dibby dibby, dibby dibby, dibby dum. All day long I'd biddy biddy bum if I were a wealthy man. How well those words capture the dreams of becoming wealthy. And he continues, I wouldn't have to work hard. Yabby dibby 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 dum. If I were a biddy biddy rich, idle diddle didle didle man. But not only does Tevye want to be relieved of the hard work and burdens of poverty, but he wants all the trappings of wealth as well. And he continues, I'd build a big tall house with roofs by the dozen right in the middle of the town, a fine tin roof with real wooden floors below. There would be one long staircase just going up and one even longer coming down, and one more leading nowhere just for show. He wants to proclaim to the world that he's truly worthy of their jealousy. As they say in Yiddish, Zoln ze platzen. I'd fill my yard with chicks and turkeys and geese and ducks for the town to see and hear, squawking just as noisily as they can, and each, and he begins to make all kinds of noises, would land like a trumpet on the ear, as if to say, here lives a wealthy man. He wants his wife to have all the luxury, wealth, and power that's befitting a wealthy man's wife. I see my wife, Golda, looking like a rich man's wife with a proper double chin, supervising meals to her heart's delight. I see her putting on airs and strutting like a peacock. Oh, what a happy mood she's in, screaming at the servants day and night. But most important, Tevye wants the respect that the world gives a wealthy man. The most important men in town will come to call on me. They will ask me to advise them like Solomon the Wise. If you please, Reb Tevye, pardon me, Reb Tevye, posing problems that would cross a rabbi's eyes. And here he becomes ecstatic. Yadi-di-da-da, yadi-da-da, yadi-da-da-da. And it wouldn't make one bit of difference if I answer right or wrong. When you're rich, they think you really know. Like all those like Tevye, the hero of the play, who has only experienced poverty all his life, Wealth is the answer to all his problems, and then some. In this lecture, I would like to analyze the blessings of wealth, the secrets of how to acquire and keep wealth, the responsibility and curses of wealth, and the secret of happiness without wealth. I have divided this lecture into 10 parts, the first letter of each part spelling out the word prosperity, as you see in the first page of your handout. The P is for poverty. Tevye said that it's no shame to be poor. It's not a shame, but it is a curse. The first quote we have from the Talmud on top of page 2 is from the Gemara Nedarim, the 64b. Four are considered in a certain sense as if they were dead. One of them is a poor man. The commentaries explain that the purpose of life is to be a giver, to be a contributor, not only to change yourself, but to change the world about you. The curse of poverty, real poverty, is that you're a taker. You're not independent. And in that sense, one who is poor is considered as if he is dead. Someone who is dead has to be carried, has to be watched, can't take care of himself, can't give anyone something. In fact, attending a funeral is called in the Talmud chesed shel emes, the kindness which is true kindness, because the person cannot pay you back. But in another sense, and this is the second quote on page 2, we find the ills of poverty go beyond merely not being able to give. In terms of oppressive poverty, when a person becomes desperate, the Talmud says that he loses his mind. He loses his senses. He loses his spirituality, his knowledge of his Creator. In fact, they become so bad, we have in bold print, that after death, he does not have to go to Gehenna. He doesn't have to go to purgatory. He's all cleaned out. He's lived a living hell. So in the sense of what poverty is, the Talmud views it as a curse. But there's something above poverty that's not yet wealth. Perhaps we call that the middle class. And then there's wealth. We now, this is one of the verses that are said when the Torah is lifted up after it's being read. And we say that the length of days is in her right hand, in her left hand are riches and honor. For those who dedicate themselves to Torah, they're blessings. Those who are on the right, who dedicate themselves with strength, the symbol of the right hand, there's a length of days, which is a symbol for the spiritual life. The left hand, though, even if one does not put his all into it, there's still a blessing. The blessings of riches and honor. What is the blessing of riches? What are riches? And here we have, this is the R, prosperity, riches. In paragraph A, we find an argument as to what is the blessing of wealth. One of those opinions is that it truly means wealth. A person has vast holdings. He employs hundreds. And it's that opinion of wealth that we will begin to explore the idea of riches and wealth. The Talmud takes the literal sense of wealth and the blessings of wealth on top of page 3. What are the blessings of wealth? And the O, again, we started with P for poverty and R for riches. The O is opportunity. We explained that the purpose of life is to change, is to give. And when a person is blessed with wealth, you can change the world. You could change it through your charity, and that's the first quote. Quote two of the greatest rabbis in the time of the Mishnah. This is between the year 100 and 200 of the Common Era. Rabbi Yehuda Hanossi, the editor of the Mishnah, and the famous Rabbi Akiva, would honor the wealthy. And the Talmud goes on to explain, because the wealthy support those that don't have wealth. He honored them because of the mitzvahs that they did, because of their great works. Wealth is an opportunity, and by the fact that they received those honors, that in turn stimulated them to continue on their good works. In paragraph B, and we're going to go back to this paragraph later on, we discuss the facet of wealth. This is a Gemara in Sukkah in 29a. That he who is wealthy is respected, as Tevye pointed out. And people listen to those that are wealthy. When you're rich, they really think you know. And because they listen to you, you have the power to influence, or otherwise you wouldn't. So you have an opportunity of directly benefiting others through your wealth, and you have the ability of influencing others because of the respect that's gotten through wealth. In fact, and this is the last paragraph, paragraph C of this, of the heading of opportunity, the prophets, according to the literal meaning of the passage in the Talmud, were all wealthy. Because in order for them to get up and to influence their generation, they had to be people that were otherwise respected. And that's why, by and large, the prophets were well-to-do people. So O is opportunity. Part of the blessing of wealth is you are blessed with the opportunity to change the world. The S, you know, prosperity, is satisfaction. When you have wealth, often you change in a very positive way. The first quote after the S of satisfaction is from a Gemara in Brachos in 57b. Three things restore a man's good spirits: beautiful sounds, sights, smells. Three things increase a man's self-esteem: a beautiful dwelling, a beautiful wife, beautiful clothes. There's a quote from F. Scott Fitzgerald in The Great Gatsby, that the rich are not like you and I. They're different. A person who travels, a person who's experienced the sights and the sounds of the world, is very often a changed person. And wealth can have a very positive effect on a person, on his spirits, on his openness. And of course, as Tevye pointed out, the fact that those who are wealthy are generally well respected gives the person that sense of self-esteem that enables him to function optimally. So the O is opportunity, S is satisfaction. But the opportunity is a double-edged sword, which we're going to discuss a little later in detail. Because it's not only an opportunity, but a responsibility. There's a very cute story about the chief rabbi of St. Petersburg in Russia some 100 years ago. His name was Rav Itzel Petterberger, Rav Itzel, Rav Yitzchok of the city of St. Petersburg. In the community in St. Petersburg, which was beyond the pale, which was in Russia proper, only Jews who had special certificates, in other words, they had to immigrate into Russia, were allowed to settle there. And the basis of giving a certificate was one had to have either a profession or a business which was necessary to further the prosperity of Russia, of the empire. So the people in this congregation were doctors, pharmacists and chemists and printers, and they were those who were involved in supplying the Tsar's army. There was one particular member of his congregation, a person that was not forthcoming. When he asked them for the various philanthropic endeavors that he was involved in, because after all, it was the wealthiest congregation in all of Russia, and letters kept on coming on his desk of all the desperate needs. Other members in this congregation gave with an open hand, but this particular person did not. One time, there was a pressing need. There was an urgent letter that was sent to the rabbi. He felt he'll give it another shot. He'll ask the person just another time to help. He went to the man's house, and his wife said he's not in. He's in shul. He's in the synagogue. It's the middle of the day. What is he doing in the synagogue? He's saying tilim. He's saying psalms. It's like extra prayers. He went to the synagogue. And there he saw the man deeply engrossed in his prayer. Rabbi sat down and waited for the man to finish. Walked over to him. He said, Rabid, whatever his name was, you're a supplier to the Tsar's army. You evidently know how the army runs.
Yeah.
What would be if a member of the artillery decided he doesn't enjoy the artillery anymore, to being a member of the artillery corps, and he wants to join the infantry? He packs his bags, he leaves his barracks, and he walks over to the barracks of the infantry. What would happen to that man? And the miser replied, well, he'd be court-martialed. Can't leave without permission. And the rabbi continued, you know, God also has an army. It's not made of members of infantry and artillery, but it is made of different facets, different parts of our community. They're the scholars, the teachers, those who spiritually enrich the community. They're the balabatim, those who are blessed with wealth, who materially enrich the congregation. And then there are those who fall into neither category, but because of their religiosity and their spirituality, devote some of the time of their day to saying Tehillim, to praying, saying Psalms. And he continued, he says, but you know what? If God had wanted to put you in the division of those that say Tehillim, those who pray, the Tehillim Zuggers, he didn't have to bless you with all this wealth. He put you in the division of those who support the world. And you are deserting. You're going AWOL. Says, you have no right to desert your position. So wealth is not only an opportunity, it's a responsibility. And in terms of the S of satisfaction, which it is true that a person who's more cosmopolitan, who's more traveled, and has had greater experiences is a broader person. But it too is a double-edged sword. Because this is a theme that we've gone over throughout the lecture series. This world is only part of our experience. We're just passing through. There's a life beyond this world. This is not the final place. But for some people in life, it may be, or at least in terms of positive experiences. Imagine, if you would, someone who's a member of the mafia. And I just saw recently a book that was offered for sale. The title of the book was, "But They Were Nice to Their Mothers." And it's all about Jewish gangsters. There are people that if we look in the sum total of their life, they are nasty people. They've hurt others, they continue to hurt others. But they do good things. At least they're nice to their mothers. One basic premise that the Torah is based on is that every good deed is repaid. There are people who can be repaid fully. And the payment for these people are not Rolls Royces or Cadillacs or large homes. The payment is an indescribable pleasure that can only be experienced outside of the body. But there are people who live a life that they can't experience that spiritual pleasure. They're too gross. We've touched upon this in a previous lecture. It would be akin to treating someone to the Detroit Philharmonic who is hooked onto heavy metal, in other words, onto hard rock. For him, going to a concert of Mozart or Beethoven or Tchaikovsky is Gehenna, you know, is purgatory. Heaven for him is going to hear Pearl Jam or to hear another group of that sort. So that's heaven. Everyone has their heaven. And for many people who won't have the spiritual out-of-body experience, heaven is on earth. So a person could have loads of satisfaction, but that's all he has. And that really, and it's a very biting kind of concept, but it runs throughout the Talmud. And I quoted one example here on the top of page 4. A beautiful little story from Sanhedrin 101a. Rabbi Eliezer was the teacher of Rabbi Akiva. Once he fell sick, he was in great distress. And Rabbi Akiva saw him, and ironically, he was happy. You can read the text here, top of page 4. And he asked him, "What are you happy for?" And he says, "You know what? I saw all your life you were successful. Everything you touched turned to gold. You had the Midas touch. And I was afraid, you know, life is too good to you. Maybe this is your last stop. Maybe you're really not such a saint after all. Once I saw that life for you is not a bowl of cherries, that life has its difficulties, I realized that you're not being paid in this world. There's more in store for you afterwards, outside of your body, in the next world." But he was really distressed, because he thought, at least there's a possibility, that the wealth is really the final payment. In other words, wealth could either be an opportunity for greater growth, to do great things in the world, to touch others and to touch yourself, or it could be, this is your final reward. It's all over. This is it. You have nothing else. Because you didn't prepare yourself for a life of giving. All you did was just involved in taking. Which takes us now to P. We've discussed, up until now, we discussed the curse of poverty, the blessings of wealth, the opportunity and the satisfaction. The question is, but if I'm not wealthy now, how do I change it? And that takes us to P, of predestiny. And this is an idea which we discussed at length in a previous lecture about how to change your luck. That we are predestined. Before we're put onto this earth, the major lines, the major outlines of our life are drawn. As we says, if a person is going to be strong or weak, wise or foolish, wealthy or poor, whether the person is going to be righteous or not is not predestined. That's totally in a person's hands. A person totally has in his power to become a good person, a better person, or the opposite. But what kind of a life he's going to lead, the family that he's going to be born into, the opportunities that will come his way, in terms of broad outlines, they are there before a person is born. But the lines get finer as one goes through life. And this is the idea that every Rosh Hashanah, from the beginning of the year, every person is judged. And the fine lines are drawn. What's going to happen this year? And in the bottom of page 4, there's an amazing quote about what a person is going to make. His gross income is set at Rosh Hashanah, with two exceptions. One is what he expends for Shabbos and Yom Tov, in other words, what he says for Sabbath and the holidays, the food that he puts on his table, the clothes that he buys, how he enjoys, how he changes from the physical to the spiritual, because that's what Shabbos is all about, Yom Tov is about. That you can spend as much as you want, you'll get it back. And the second is what you invest in your children's education. If you teach your children Torah, the money that goes towards Torah, you get back. But otherwise, it's set. And it's a fascinating thing they're saying about the idea of not squandering what you've been given. A book recently came out, written by two marketing professors, Thomas J. Stanley, William D. Danko. It's called The Millionaire Next Door, and it was reviewed in the Wall Street Journal on August 4th of this year. And what they said, and just summarizing the review, which is itself a summary, people who buy $1,200 suits have high incomes, but tend to exhaust their lucre. Unless you have it, but you just exhausted it. People, again, this is only statistical. People who scrimp and save are those that become wealthy. Sam Walton drove a pickup. Warren Buffett, until recent years, wore cheap suits. Statistically, the typical millionaire lives in an unremarkable house next to non-rich neighbors. He drives an old car and is a fastidious saver. The majority of millionaires own small businesses, often gritty ones. Of course, this is not necessarily the super rich, but those who we would call wealthy people generally don't squander that which is allotted to them on Rosh Hashanah. So one idea of predestiny is, in the broader picture, the broader outlines are there before a person's born. The fine lines are drawn every Rosh Hashanah. And a person shouldn't squander it. There's another idea, which is on top of page 5. Wealth is considered a revolving wheel, a galgal hachozer. It's a revolving wheel. Those who are wealthy now won't necessarily be wealthier, their families, in years to come. There's a beautiful story which is told, which I heard from Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky. Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky is a maggid. He is a preacher. He's a person who goes from town to town to entertain audiences with his stories, with his Torah. And he tells a personal story when he was a young man. And he was exiled, and this was World War II, to Siberia. And with him, working side by side, was an elderly man. An elderly man that he got to know when he was a yeshiva bocher, living in Bialystok. This man spoke to Yaakov Galinsky, was a young man, a boy then, and he told him, "I'm very angry at the rabbis. They're both working very hard in Siberia." He says, "Why?" He says, "You know, I always gave. I gave to the yeshivas, I supported. But they should have stood on top of me and pressed me to give more." He says, "The wealth that I had was not something that I built overnight. It was a family fortune that had existed for 300 years. It was a business that grew and grew for hundreds of years. And in one instance, the communists overran Lithuania and took everything that I had. I just have the shirt on my back, and I'm a slave laborer now in Siberia. And if at least they had forced me to give more, at least I would have something. Now I have nothing." It was a wheel of fortune. It had stood for 300 years, but the wheel came down. There's a beautiful story that's told of Shmuel HaNogid. Shmuel HaNogid was the vizier, was the vice king, to the king of Granada. I don't know if you're familiar with the Alhambra. It's a beautiful southern Spain. It's this beautiful palace. It was built by this Shmuel HaNogid for the king of Granada. He was the highest Jewish official in a Muslim kingdom. And he was the subject of much envy and much plotting. And once his enemies created a false rumor and said that he was skimming, basically he was skimming the top of the king's income, that he was pocketing money himself. Besides the generous salary he was given, he was pocketing extra monies. This was the rumor that his enemies had created. The king dismissed it. He knew he was a great scholar. He was a very man of integrity. But he kept on hearing this rumor again and again. And he felt that he finally had to squash this rumor. He called in Shmuel HaNogid and says, "Tomorrow I want you to come back to the palace and present to me an itemized list of your income, all your assets. So show me all that you owe." The next day, he came back to the palace with a large itemized list. It's a long list and a sum total. He looked at the numbers, looked at the sum total. He said, "There's something very wrong here. So this number is much less than I know that you own." And Shmuel replied to the king, "You asked me for my assets. These are my assets. This is the list of my charities. That's what I really own. Because after all, the rest is just here for a fleeting moment. This list is for all eternity." And this is, that feeling was expressed by Nebuchadnezzar, this great formal entrepreneur, philanthropist, man of the world, who lost everything in an instant and bemoaned the fact that he had the opportunity to do more, but didn't. So one of the ideas of predestiny is that even if one is blessed with wealth, one cannot take it for granted. But what happens if you want to change that which is destined? Fine, there are those who are born rich and those that aren't. I want to change. And the Talmud says it's possible to change. And here we're at page 5. E is effort. What must a man do? This is a quote from Talmud Nida and Ayin Omid Beis in 70b. What must a man do to become rich? And the Talmud answers he has to do two things. He has to engage in business honestly, and he has to pray. As we've explained in previous lectures, prayer is not some magical incantation. Prayer is not just a wish list or you demand from God, give me this and give me that. Prayer is an invitation to invite God into your life. It's you make God a partner in your life. That's what prayer is. To the extent that you invite Him in, He's there. But you just can't pray and sit and do nothing. You have to be involved honestly. You're involved honestly in some endeavor that should provide income, the blessing will be there. So one idea, of course, is the idea of prayer. But besides the prayer, one has to work. And the Talmud is full of advice of how to deal in different parts of the Talmud, how to make the most of your money. One, which you probably, if you've heard many times from your financial advisor, is diversify. And this is on paragraph B in the bottom of page 5. To a certain extent, you should always be liquid, just in case something comes your way. If you had invested last Friday in the stock market, you would have done well. You have to be liquid. In the second paragraph, one should always divide his wealth into three parts. A third in land, real estate, there's a third, it's not the exact third, it's one part. A third in merchandise, and a third ready to hand. Now there's the idea, basically, that one should be liquid. The Talmud also stresses preserving wealth. And this is on top of page 6, and you can just read it yourself. Don't squander your wealth. And if you have a business, stay on top of it. Make sure your workmen don't destroy your business. And the clothing and the vessels that you buy, make sure that they last. The Talmud, in another instance, this is a Gemara in Psachim in 113a, suggests that also, if you're involved in a business, if it possible, you should minimize credit and try to get cash. Which reminds me of the cute story I recently read of the ragged beggar who came to Mrs. Friedman's doorstep to collect his weekly donation. "I'm sorry," she told him. "I have no money in the house today. Please come back tomorrow." The beggar became very angry. "Tomorrow," he grumbled. "All right, but don't let it happen again. I've lost a virtual fortune extending credit." Besides prayer, and of course besides using your money wisely, on page 6 we deal with one of the great secrets of wealth. This is on paragraph D. Giving tzedakah, giving charity. And here the Talmud deals with tithing. That in a certain sense, that a person gives a certain percentage, sets it aside for higher purposes. And in a certain sense, it's the easiest way of giving charity. Very often, people come to our doors, letters come through our mailbox, asking for this cause and that cause. It's hard to give. It's hard to take money that you were thinking about putting into furniture or to food or to this or to that and to take that money and to give it to someone else. But if you have a plan, you create, in a sense, a charitable trust that you've set aside beforehand money that goes, "This is not my money. This is charity's money." And when you get a charitable, when people come and ask you, You look, well, you treat it as if you're a trustee. How much money is in the trust? How much money can I afford to give or not? It's not my money that I'm giving. I'm just a trustee. You take the pain away from that giving, and very often it becomes very pleasurable. But part of the idea is that one has to have that sense that God is a partner in his life. Whatever you do, there's at least a certain amount, 10% or perhaps 20%, that's God's. Remember, I heard a cute joke some years ago about a group of poor tailors. They were friends. They went to tailoring school together. Each one opened a shop in a different part of the city. And none of them did very well. And every few years they would come together and they would talk of old times. And each one would drive up in an old Chevrolet. Many years passed. And would talk about the difficulties they're having of business today, and of business of yesteryear, and the good times they had when they were young. One meeting, which happened 5 years from the last time they met, one of those old friends drove up in a Rolls Royce that was chauffeured. And he came out dressed exquisitely. I mean, they were all tailors, but the cost of the material and the tailoring was evident. It wasn't something that he himself designed. It was something that he had imported. And he had all the airs of someone who was very successful. And when the old friends came together and they started talking, and we said about the stories and the tzaras and this of his shop and his business, when they would come to the man who just came, walked out of the Rolls Royce, he was saying, "Ah, Adank Ugot, Baruch Hashem, thank God, business is doing very well." I said, "What happened? We all started the same." Well, after the last meeting, I began to think, why is it I'm working so hard and I'm just not getting anywhere? So I started to pray. And in my prayers, I got this brilliant idea. And he says, "God, you've been with my life. You've been with me my whole life. It's about time that I make you a partner in my business. I'll take a salary. I'll take expenses to run the business. And after that, we'll split it." And from that time on, I don't know where the customers came from. They came from all sides. I had to hire one tailor, another tailor. The shop was too small. It says I opened up one store and another store. I decided not only to do tailoring, but to bring in clothing from other stores, pre-tailored clothing. I have stores in every state. I specialize in women's clothing. He says, "Yeah. What's the name of your store?" He says, "Lord and Taylor." But the idea of giving miser, of giving a tithe, is making the Lord a partner. And part, of course, of the idea is, we spoke about opportunity, is doing good things with your money. And here we have on paragraph F, it says, if a man is blessed with wealth, it says, your wife who struggled with you should be repaid and should be honored. It says, and one who honors his wife, who uses his blessings wisely, is blessed with further wealth. But as we stated before, that it's also responsibility. So again, in prosperity, we had P, poverty, the curse of poverty, R, the blessings of wealth, O, the opportunity, the S, the satisfaction, P, the predestiny, and how it's predestined every Rosh Hashanah, E, the effort. Now, R, prosperity, is responsibility. We're on page 7. The idea of wealth is that it's given on loan. And if we don't use it, it could be taken away from us. It could be taken away from us. It's a tremendous responsibility. There's a beautiful story of the Chofetz Chaim, a great rabbi of Eastern Europe before World War II, of Yisrael Meir HaKoyen Kagan. The story goes that he had a dream. And after that dream, what are you fasting today? He says, I dreamt I became wealthy. So what's so wrong? It was terrible. It was a nightmare. I had streams of widows and orphans and yeshivas. And I didn't know who to give to first, and everyone's giving out their hand. Should I give to this one? Should I give out to... Am I giving enough? I couldn't make those decisions. And when I woke up, and it came to my same home, and it was just me, it was such a relief. And I fasted. Wealth is a tremendous responsibility. And just as we spoke before about satisfaction, the person could grow through wealth. The person could also be spoiled through wealth. There's a beautiful story, folk story, of a miser who came to a rabbi for a blessing. He was involved in a certain business deal, and he wanted the rabbi's blessing. And the rabbi felt uncomfortable with the man, with his shortcomings, the fact that he was blessed with wealth, and didn't help the way he should. And the miser was in the rabbi's home, and he took the miser to his front window. And they're looking out on the street, and he says, what do you see? He says, pointed the miser to his window. I see all the people walking back and forth. He says, now come over here. And he took him to the mirror that was hanging on his wall. He says, what do you see now? I see myself. He says, you know the difference between the mirror and the pane of glass that's in my front window? My mirror, the back of it is coated with silver. It's with that silver coating that you only see yourself. He says, your silver was not a blessing, but a curse. And wealth, in a certain sense, is the most difficult of all tests. You know, the rabbis teach us there are many tests in life. Poverty is a terrible test. Wealth is a terrible test. The test, do you use the opportunity correctly? The test, you don't become spoiled by it. They asked Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, one of the great rabbis in Europe, he says, what's the most difficult test, poverty or wealth? And he thought a moment and he said, the most difficult test in life is wealth. He says, and let me explain this to you. If we have two people that are deathly sick, someone who has heart disease and someone who has some terrible liver disease, both are almost at death's door. All things being equal, the one who has the greatest advantage is the one who lives next door to the hospital. He says, poverty is a terrible, terrible challenge. Can you remain honest? He says, when you're stuck with all the problems of making a livelihood, will you sacrifice your values? Wealth is a terrible, terrible challenge. But at least the poor are closer to God. Korav Hashem ul nishburei lev. God is closer to a person who is humbled, has a broken heart. When you're poor, you tend to feel more helpless, and you tend to pray more. So those who are poor at least live closer to the hospital. You know, it's like the cute little story. I say this story of President Reagan. We've told this story before. President Reagan came one year and visited the Vatican. And on the Pope's desk, there were various phones. There was a large red phone, and there was a large white phone. And he asked the the president asked the Pope, what's that red phone? That's a direct line to the Kremlin. And what's the white phone? That's a direct line to heaven. Could I use it? Yeah, but just be very careful. It's very costly. So he picked up, spoke a few minutes. A little while later, Reagan was visiting Jerusalem and went to the prime minister's office. And again, oddly enough, he saw those two phones, the big red one and the big white one. And he asked, what's that red one there? It's a direct line to the Kremlin. And the white one? He says, oh, says, that's a direct line to God. Can I talk? Sure. Don't worry, I'll only speak a few minutes. No, talk as long as you want. From here, it's a local call. When you're poor, it's more of a local call. Life, the purpose of being here in life is being challenged. The only people that are not challenged are those that are dead. There are all kinds of challenges. But a person has to be prepared to meet those challenges. A person has to think himself, are you really prepared to become wealthy? A lot of challenges. Because there's another alternative. And here, this is the end of our lecture. The last three letters are I, T, and U. I is independence. We spoke about the curse of poverty. But there's a middle road. A road that you don't have to come on to the charity of others. That you're self-sufficient. And that itself is a blessing. It may come with difficulty, but it's honest and it's yours. That's I, independence. T is true riches. We spoke of one definition of wealth in terms of actual money, fields, employees. There's another form of riches, and this we quote on page 8. Ezehu Oshir Hasameh Bechalko. Who is rich who is happy with his lot? Wealth, this one says, the city of wealth is in a state of mind. If you appreciate what you have, you're very wealthy. You have everything. In the historic moment that Esau met Jacob, Jacob tells his brother wanted to give him something, Yeshli Kol, I have everything. Hasomech Bechelko, someone who's happy with his lot, has everything. For many people, life is a game. I was once recently seen on a bumper sticker. The one who dies with the most toys wins. It's a game. It's a game of collecting toys. But if you appreciate what you have all the wealth you need. That's T. The U, the Y is you. You have to be able also to appreciate yourself. Tevye keeps on singing of how he wants to impress others. He wants the large house. He wants the geese and turkeys. He wants to be respected. But ultimately, respect comes within yourself. If you realize how important you truly are, and that's the quote on the bottom of page 8, we're all created in God's image. As Jews, we have the beautiful blessing of being the chosen people. We were given a Torah. We were given a means to be a light to all of humanity. There's so much to appreciate. If you appreciate yourself, you're really truly blessed with wealth. On the end of Tevye's song, he expresses the final wish, if I were rich, and you can look at the bottom, page 9, I have the time to sit in the synagogue and pray. and maybe have a seat by the eastern wall. I would discuss the holy books with learned men 7 hours every day. It would be the sweetest thing of all. You don't need to be extremely wealthy to spend your time well and to grow. Of course, Tevye experienced the curse of poverty. But one can experience many of the blessings of wealth and the satisfaction and using your time wisely without those blessings. But if you want those blessings, and we've sketched very roughly how to obtain that wealth, you really have to ask yourself, are you willing and able to make the commitment that comes with the wealth to help others, to grow through life, not to be the person who just looks through the mirror and the silver obstructs his view. He only sees himself. But you maintain that clearer view of life. That's really the challenge. And if you do, if you meet that challenge, you are truly wealthy. Thank you.
My question is, you came to a point saying that an individual must have challenges in their lives to become wealthy. Does challenges actually also include someone to take risks in their lifetime?
Let me just repeat the question, okay? I just don't understand the question. You're speaking about the challenges. We spoke about challenges of poverty, wealth. You're speaking about the challenges which are really self-imposed challenges.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. The challenges of risk-taking.
Right.
Let me explain what challenges are in this context.
Sure.
Yeah. In the general context, you know, the first person who scaled Mount Everest, Sir Edmund Hillary, was asked, why did you scale Mount Everest? Why did you climb it for? And his answer was, because it was there. Because it was there. Many of the challenges we go through life are to try to prove to ourselves that we are capable, we are somebodies. People who climb mountains do so not only the thrill of climbing the mountain, but in the sense of it's the thrill of winning. It's overcoming that challenge. Like climb every mountain. There's another kind of challenge. This is really the challenge that I was speaking of. From the Torah's viewpoint, we are put here on this world to change ourselves, to change the world about us. And we are given the ability to make those changes and to make those decisions. We are not programmed. We have free will. Very often it's hard to exercise that free will. We're pushed from all directions, from the society around us, from our family, from our own inner drives. There may be this small voice within us saying, yes, but it's the right thing to do, and the other voice we hear from the other area, but imagine how much trouble you're going to have because of it. And we're pulled this way and we're pulled that way, and ultimately we have to create ourselves. We're not knowing that we're being pushed this way and that way. We ultimately have to make that decision. And the final product is something that we created. The challenges in life are really the ability for us to exercise our free will. If no one had any challenges, everything would be simple.
So first, yeah, first, understandably, I have to be good and honest and decent and fine. And what happens when everyone starts yelling at you? What happens when you feel that you're being robbed? What happens if you feel that you are not given the position or the honors or the respect or the love that you're deserving? How do you react then? Then it's a lot tougher. And despite that, you're able to make yourself a fine and decent and loving and caring individual. You've won the fight of life. And that really is the challenge of life. The challenge of life is, are you going to withstand all the pressures and still maintain your integrity? That's really, from the Jewish viewpoint, that's the challenge of life. There are other challenges of life. There's the risk-taking. Those are challenges. But one has to know, it says, what the nature of those challenges are. Are they just there to prove yourself? And that's because if everything goes easily, then it's nothing. A person who's an heir to a fortune and does nothing with it, there's an empty feeling. If a person invests and takes challenges and takes risks, and you're successful, I did something. That's true in leading a moral life as well. But that goes beyond like the subject of this lecture. I don't know if did I answer it well.
The reason I was asking is I've read quite a few books by many different authors, and I guess this comes more not necessarily being wealthy, but being successful in life. It says that the successful individuals out there are the ones that do take risks in life that will be successful. And I guess we're not necessarily talking money-wise too, but just taking risks in life. Because life is not very simple, like you explained.
Yeah, that point is very, very well taken. Someone who opens a business, any business, is taking a risk. You're investing. Anyone who opens an office is taking a risk. Anyone who gets married is taking a risk and has children is taking a risk. If you sit and do nothing, nothing happens. The key in life, though, is to gauge your risks. Your risk tolerance? And that really divides the person who has the knack or that the street smarts to know what kind of risk is takeable and what is not. Really defines the people who are successful or not. There are people who go gambling every day. They're taking all kinds of risks. Statistically, down the line, they'll be losers. The wrong kind of risks. So in order to get ahead in life, it's true, you do have to take risks. But they have to be calculated risks. Because if you take too many of uncalculated risks, statistically, it's the person who's... I read a cute story the other day. Someone who was a habitual gambler... went out the night with his wife. He started off with money. He squandered everything. All he was left with was $2. So he woke up the next morning. His wife was still sleeping in bed. Figured, you know what? He has only $2 left. Give it a try. He went to the racetrack. I don't know. He put $2 on some horse, Schlamazel, and he put $2 on some horse. It was a 50-to-1 shot. Right? And from his $2, it became $100. Now he had $100. He took the $100 and he went and started playing roulette. And he went back to the gambling house where his wife was in the hotel. His wife was still asleep. And he went to the gambling house. And he started multiplying. And from 100, it became 1,000. Became 10,000. It became $50,000. He's winning. And he put all the $50,000 on red. And it went round and round and round, and it turned on black. Anyways, he went upstairs. His wife had woken up already. And he said, the wife asked him, what happened, honey? Nah, I just lost $2. And there are risks and there are risks. Okay.
Rabbi, we have a question.
Okay.
I distinctly notice in the direction of your comments that you believe that really there is areas of disagreement between the values of our society and the traditional Jewish values. As we all know, we live in a consumer society. We live in a society where if people buy fewer cars, immediately are supposed to be concerned that consumer spending is down and all the dreadful consequences of that. And so that many of us who are in the economically oriented world are constantly preoccupied with such issues, and the society reinforces it. It appears that the entire welfare of the society is based on this idea of consuming, buying, and producing, and of course creating a lot of garbage. I was wondering what your comments would be in terms of this apparent conflict between Torah wisdom and contemporary social values in our society.
Okay. The question was asked, just to summarize, in three words or less, that basically what George was asking was that if we would all start becoming more ascetic, in other words, we would buy less, wouldn't be so driven with the values of society at large, if each and every one of us would do so, awful lot of people out of work, a lot of car salesmen, a lot of people who are creating cars now on the assembly line in Ford and GM. UPS will have to lay off a lot more people. That may be the case. Could be. But pretend we have an underworld society. And that society sells marijuana and cocaine and heroin, and many people become fabulously wealthy. They do great business, despite all the efforts of the government to close them down. But we know instinctively that it's the wrong thing. And even though we know by closing them down, there are many people that otherwise are not prepared to make a living because they don't have the wherewithal to, they don't have the training to make a living. But we feel it's in society's best interests to close it down. We live in a life, a society that's involved in what we call fun or toys or being tickled. And we're so busy playing with our toys or being tickled, we never stop to think about, it's like the stop the world, I want to get off. What's this all about? What am I living this for? What am I putting all this effort into? There's a very cute story that one of the heads of the yeshivas in Cleveland, Mordechai Gifter, should be well, tells over when he visited Mexico City and he was raising money for his yeshiva. And he came to an individual, a wealthy individual, but it was very hard to get into that person because he would only take visitors from 11:30 at night to 7 o'clock in the morning. They had an appointment to see him 6:30 in the morning. They came to his home. He was really too busy to see them. He was already on the phone. He was making this deal and that deal. It was 5 to 7 when he finally got off the phone from all his deals. And he went and spoke to the rabbi and said, "Well, how can I help you? I only have 5 minutes. I'm just going to be out the door." And the rabbi knew in 5 minutes there was no way for him to explain the importance of the institution he represented. He says, "I just don't have the time. Maybe another time when I visit Mexico City. One thing I'd like to ask you. You leave the house at 7 o'clock.
You're not home till 11, 11:30 at night. I come at 6:30, you're on the phone already. He says, you live in a beautiful home. I look at your furniture, I look at your paintings, the carpets. He says, who's this all for? How could you enjoy this? And he replied, Rabbi, I don't enjoy any of this. This is for my wife and kids. I'm just totally involved in business. Because Rabbi, let me tell you one thing. If you want to get ahead in life, you got to be focused. That's his advice. You got to be focused. So here, he had this wonderful home, wonderful everything, but he was so involved in this, it became a habit, like a person who's on cocaine or heroin. And we become, society has addicted us to all the toys. And it's in a certain sense like we lived in, instead of being in the underworld, but out in the street they sold cocaine and heroin and marijuana. Everybody's totally involved in this. You know, it used to be in China and Turkey, and it was a problem, the opium dens. The people used to spend their lives just being in these opium dens and just wasting away. Or into these bars. I mean, people just stay there and get drunk. Just because everyone does it, doesn't mean, of course, that it's right. Rabbi Jacobowitz tells over a beautiful story. I think we've told the story over once. It doesn't illustrate this exactly, but it's a beautiful, beautiful story. This is in New York. If anyone's been in Brooklyn, there's a highway called the Belt Parkway. And a person, unfortunately, entered on the exit ramp of the Belt Parkway. So he entered on the exit ramp, and he's going one way. All the cars, and it can be very busy, are all going the other way. And you can imagine the scene. He's driving, and all the cars are coming and trying to avoid him this way and that way, and the screeching and the horns. And he turns on the radio. And it happens to be, he says, on traffic. If you turn on in New York, 880, he says, every 10 minutes on the 8th, just like over here, there's traffic. He hears the traffic report. He says, there's a traffic alert on Belt Parkway. He says, there's someone who's driving in the wrong direction. All those out there should be extremely careful. And the guy who's listening to this says, one guy? There are thousands of them. Your question was, what will happen to society? I don't know what will happen to society. But one thing I know, what will happen to the individual, that if a person stops being addicted to all his toys and starts living life and enjoying what he really does have and takes some of his blessings and enriches the lives of others, it's worth everything. You've kicked the habit. I don't know what will happen to society. But you and everyone else who kicks the habit, I'm sure, will lead a much more fulfilled life. Okay, good night.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237, or call 1-800-797-7729.